We hear our readings from Scripture now, first of all from the Old Testament, from Isaiah chapter 55 and page 742 in the Pew Bibles. Isaiah 55 and verses 1 to 7. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labour on what does not satisfy? Listen, listen to me, and eat what is good, and your soul will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me. Hear me that your soul may live. I will make an everlasting covenant with you, my faithful love promised to David. See, I have made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander of the peoples. Surely you will summon nations you know not, and nations that do not know you will hasten to you, because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the evil man his thoughts. Let him turn to the Lord and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will freely pardon. And from the New Testament, from John's Gospel chapter 2 and verses 1 to 11. And this is the passage we'll be thinking about later in the service. John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11 is on page 1064 of the Pew Bibles. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. May God bless to us our readings from his word this morning, and may he teach us from them. I just mentioned that in the services I should take, and the two Bible studies I'm taking as well, between now and Easter, I intend to look at John's Gospel, incidents from John's Gospel. And this morning, the wedding at Cana in Galilee. Now, one of the endearing things about weddings is that you always remember if anything goes wrong. You know, wasn't that the wedding where they dropped the cake? And when I was a trainee minister, I was involved in a wedding where the bridegroom fainted, and it was a church with pews, and they propped him up in the front pew, you know, and gave him a glass of water, and there was this white-faced figure. "Do you take this woman to be your lawful wedding?" "I do." One of my favourite stories, it was from Bristol. A friend of mine was a curate in the Anglican church in Bristol, and he'd only just started there. He was playing football for a local football club, and he'd changed into this football gear in the house he was staying in. And the vicar had gone on holiday, and the vicar had forgotten that he'd booked a wedding at the church. And there was this chap, you see, the curate, in his football gear, and there was this frantic knocking on the door, and there was this distraught bride and groom saying, "We've got to the church and it's all locked up." So he put his robes on over his football things and clattered down to the church. They managed to rustle up an organist from somewhere, and they started the wedding service. And in the middle of the wedding service, the curate suddenly realised he hadn't got the faintest clue what this couple was called. So he turned to each of them in turn and said, "What is thy name?" And they thought it was part of the service, you see, and they told him their full name. When you take a wedding service, you have that wonderful sense of power when you come to that those words, you know. "Does anyone know any just impediment why these two should not be married? Let him speak now or forever hold his peace." And then you leave a long, pregnant pause, you see. It's only happened once to me, and that was in Kenya. And the father of the bride objected, and we had, because we had to stop the wedding service and everything and see what the objection was. But it was to do with the bride price. He wasn't getting enough goats. And although it was a very deep-seated tribal custom, obviously the bride price, in the law of the Republic of Kenya and in the rules of the church, it wasn't even, recognised. So it wasn't something that you could stop a wedding for, even though he was very upset about it. The best wedding story, actually, that I've ever heard also comes from Kenya. And it was told to me by one of the African ministers, who told me that he'd once married a man to the wrong woman. Now, what happened was the chap had the groom had changed his mind on the Friday night and decided he was going to marry someone else, and he took this other girl with him. Now, you could have as many as 6 weddings on a Saturday, and I mean, one African bride done up in a veil and everything looks like any other African bride done up in a veil. And this couple apparently arrived at the church on time, which was unheard of. I mean, nobody ever arrives on time anywhere in Africa. But they arrived on time, and he took the wedding. And then, as they were finishing the service, another bride appeared in the doorway. And he said, "What's going on?" She said, "You've just married my husband-to-be to somebody else." And there was a terrible to-do. All the brothers appeared with spears. And they had to call in the police and what have you, see. Now, the awful thing is, if something goes wrong at a wedding, that's what you will always remember. Wasn't that the wedding when such and such went wrong? Now, Jesus once attended a wedding which very nearly ended in disaster. And it was the presence of Jesus at the feast that saved the situation and saved people from thinking ever after, "Wasn't that the wedding where, to their great disgrace, the wine ran out?" And he didn't just stop a disaster, he transformed the situation. Now, as you probably know, you all know the 4 Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. Matthew, Mark and Luke have many similarities. Scholars give them a fancy name. They're called the Synoptic Gospels. It means they can be compared with one another. I don't know if I'm the only person here who's an avid listener to the shipping forecast. It used to amuse my friend Brian, I used to go to the cricket with, used to amuse him tremendously that at 12:03, as we're sitting watching the cricket, I'd say, "It's time for the shipping forecast," and they'd put my earpiece in and radio on and hear the shipping forecast. If you hear the shipping forecast, they begin by saying, "First, a general synopsis. High over the Azores, 1020, slow moving. Fast moving, low over Biscay, moving towards Rockall 995. Expected Rockall 990, 12 noon tomorrow." A synopsis, it means you lay this down, you could compare them, you see. So they called the Synoptic Gospels because you can compare them. There are lots of similarities, lots of similar sayings that obviously came from a common source and so on. But John's Gospel is a different sort of book altogether. It's thought that it was written much later than the others by John the Apostle, after years of reflection on what he'd experienced as a disciple of Jesus. And his aim is set out at the end of John's Gospel. He makes it clear what he's trying to get over to us is who Jesus is. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. John just picks out seven miracles. There are just seven miracles recorded in John's Gospel. Lots and lots of other ones in Matthew, Mark and Luke. John picks out seven miracles and he calls them signs because they each one tell us something about who Jesus is. And we're invited to look at each miracle on various levels. The story of the feeding of the 5,000 is a very good example. I mean, you know the story very well. There was a big crowd. They were listening to Jesus. It was a remote place. There was nowhere for them to get food. All they had, Jesus and the disciples, were five loaves and two fish. And Jesus blessed them and everybody was miraculously fed. It's in all four Gospels as it happens. It's one of the very few incidents that is recorded by all the four Gospel writers. Now, there's absolutely no doubt that John believed that Jesus miraculously fed a large crowd of people near the Sea of Galilee. In some ways, his is the most vivid account because he's the only one who mentions the boy with his picnic lunch being brought to Jesus by Andrew. But there is also no doubt that John wants us to look further and see deep, important spiritual lessons behind the story. He records the words of Jesus about his being the bread of life and the importance of feeding daily on him. When Jesus heals a blind man in John chapter 9, we hear about his telling the Pharisees about their spiritual blindness. So let's look at this story of the water into wine and let's see the different levels. It took place at Cana in Galilee, not far from Nazareth. There's certain points about the story that suggest that Jesus and Mary might have been related to the bride or the groom. A Jewish wedding was preceded by a betrothal. Every year at Christmas, we read about a virgin betrothed to a man. Betrothal was, I always say, it's like engagement, when people get engaged in our culture, but it's engagement plus. It was a bit more binding than an engagement in our own way of doing things. If a man died while a couple was betrothed, the woman was counted to be a widow. All the arrangements for the wedding were made during that year of betrothal. And when the wedding arrived, there was a procession through the village and it was followed by a week of celebrations. For that week, the bride and groom were treated as if they were a king and a queen. Their commands were followed. It was the highlight of their lives. And Jesus and his disciples seemed to have come in the middle of all this. And then a great crisis arose, possibly because Jesus and at least six of the disciples turned up. The wine ran out. You can imagine the fuss and the flap, the whispered messages and the embarrassment on all sides. This would be how this couple would always be remembered. The couple at whose wedding the wine ran out, their marriage blighted from the beginning. Now Mary was at the feast. And it was she who brought the message to Jesus. The scriptures tell us very little of Mary, really, or of the home life of Jesus. After all, he lived at Nazareth for 30 years. The silent years, as we call them, are very silent indeed. As far as we can make out, he had brothers and sisters. As far as we can see, no one at Nazareth thought of him as particularly religious. He did have a brother called James, who belonged to the party of the Pharisees. He was the strict religious one. And years later, in the letter of James in the New Testament, James wrote, "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself untainted from the world." Almost as if he were saying, fool that I was, attempting to please God by the mass of rules and regulations and rituals that pass for religion amongst the Pharisees, and missing the real thing being lived out day by day before me. Now, in the early church, various legendary writings arose to try and fill in those early years, and they tell of miracles that Jesus performed when he was growing up, some of them so far-fetched as to be absolutely ridiculous. But John's Gospel says very clearly, this was the first miracle he performed. So we are left with very little knowledge of what happened in those first 30 years, save for one little story in Luke about them going up to the temple in Jerusalem when Jesus was 12, when he went up with his parents. Perhaps we're not meant to know, but we do note this. Mary trusted him. When there was a crisis, she turned to him. And such confidence must have grown over the years as she saw that she could depend on him. She saw that he was faithful and reliable. I should just mention about the words in verse 4, they seem very harsh to us. They're not quite so harsh in the original Greek, but it could be that Jesus was just telling her that he had to do things in his own way, in his own time, that he cannot be used or manipulated, which is a lesson we all have to learn. He's not there at our beck and call. Now, just within the door, there were these 6 stone jars, massive containers with water, and they were used for ceremonial cleansing. Strict Jew, even they went, I suppose Jews are still like this. We hear about these strict Jews who faced persecution in New York. They're probably still like this. If they go out into the world, they have a ceremonial washing as they come in through the door, because you might have touched a Gentile or you might have been close to a particularly bad sinner or something like that. So you have this ceremonial washing. So you wash away the sin from outside that you might have been contaminated with in the world. And it is from those stone jars that eventually the finest wine was drawn. Thus, the presence of Jesus transformed the situation and changed disaster into triumph. We note also in the story it was a wedding and it was a celebration, and Jesus was not in any way out of place. There are some people for whom religion is a very sober and serious thing. They're deeply suspicious of any kind of celebration. Dr. Johnson once said about the Puritans that he sometimes thought they were against bear baiting, not because of the cruelty to the bears, but because of the pleasure it gave the spectators. Dr. Spurgeon said, "Sepulchral tones may fit a man to be an undertaker, but Lazarus is not called out of his grave by hollow moans. I commend cheerfulness to all who would win souls. There will be more souls led to heaven by one who wears heaven in his face than by one who wears Tartarus in his looks." We note also that it was an ordinary home in Galilee and Jesus was not out of place there. Well, that's what happened, and it's a wonderful story in its own right. Jesus miraculously turned water into wine. But as I said, John's Gospel invites us to look a bit deeper. If the feeding of the 5,000 is meant to be a picture of the more glorious fact that Jesus Christ can feed the hungry souls of men and women, if the raising of Lazarus, that glorious crowning miracle of the 7 miracles recorded in John's Gospel, is a picture of the fact that the voice of Jesus, the voice of power, can reach and raise those long dead in trespasses and sins, in darkness of unbelief, to a new life in him, these miracles portray the gospel in a form it would take volumes to explain, then what would John want us to learn? Well, every detail in John's gospel is important. He mentions those stone jars. As I say, when people came in, they used the water from those jars to wash themselves, to ceremonially clean themselves, to show that they were washing away the uncleanness of the world outside as they came into the home. They were symbols of the old religion, which had degenerated into a set of rules and observances, of outward signs, like washing your hand when you came in to the house to wash, ceremonially wash away the sin from outside. Outward signs instead of inward change. We know, for example, how the idea of keeping the Sabbath day as a special day had developed into a ridiculously complicated set of rules about what was work and what wasn't work. Jesus came to take the old Jewish religion and make it new. So, for John, I'm sure, the changing of the water into wine was the changing of the old religion of rules and regulations into the new religion of the heart that Jesus had brought. Just as he can change the old mistaken ideas of trying to earn salvation by our own efforts into a sudden realization and an understanding of the saving grace of God, with all the joy and all the freedom that come with that realization. So Jesus came to take away all that old legalism of lists and petty regulations and all the weary round of sacrifices and ceremonies in the temple, and to replace them with the law written on our hearts and a sacrifice to end all sacrifices made for the sins of the whole world. So that's one lesson you could perhaps learn, one picture this story brings home to us. But I believe we're meant to understand this as well. There is no situation, no life, no home, no marriage, no church which Jesus Christ cannot change, because Jesus Christ changes things. Whether it's a stable at Bethlehem, whether it's a home at Nazareth, whether it's a boat on the Sea of Galilee, whether it's a donkey on Palm Sunday, whether it's a cross on Good Friday, if you used that symbol, and in the days of Jesus, if you, some people saw you with a cross on the end of a necklace or a cross on a badge or any kind of depiction of the cross, people would shudder with horror because it stood for the most horrible, ghastly death you could imagine. And Jesus transformed it into a symbol of hope and salvation. And a tomb is a place of despair and sadness, and he transformed it into a place of victory. Jesus Christ changes things. He saves the situation, transforms the situation, as he did at that wedding in Cana in Galilee. The pity is that we don't always believe that he changes things, that he can change things. But the world looks for it in our churches and in our lives, and rightly so. As a non-Christian philosopher once said, they will have to sing better songs before I believe in their Saviour. They will have to look like the redeemed. So we have seen how Jesus was not out of place at a village wedding, how his presence made all the difference and averted disaster, and how Jesus in his love and his grace brings new life in place of legalism and petty regulations, which too often religion can decline into. But above all, how Jesus Christ changes things, homes, situations, lives, even ours. John says it was his first miracle. It most certainly was not his last. Amen.